today. I want to read to you from the 56th Psalm. It's a Psalm of David. David is in a very difficult place, and as I read these words, I hope that you can't fully identify with them this morning, but maybe you can. Maybe there's a verse here and there that you say, that sounds like my life today. So I want to read it and come to some resolutions that are in this passage that are for me and perhaps are for you as well. Let me begin reading in verse 1. It says, "Be merciful to me, O God, for men hotly pursue me. All day long they press their attack. My slanderers pursue me all day long. Many are attacking me in their pride. But I am afraid I will trust in you. In God whose word I praise, in God I trust, I will not be afraid. What can mortal man do to me? All day long they twist my words. They are always plotting to harm me. They conspire, they lurk, they watch my steps, eager to take my life. On my account, let them escape in your anger, O God. Bring down the nations. Record my lament. List my tears on your scroll. Are they not in your record? Then my enemies will turn back when I call for help. But this I will know, that God is for me. In God whose word I praise, the Lord whose name, whose word I praise. In God I will trust. I will not be afraid. What can man do to me? I am under vows to you, O God. I will present my thank offerings to you. For you have delivered me from death and my feet from stumbling, that I may walk before God in the light of life." Amen. I can't read this passage without chuckling, thinking of a story that David Sebastian, who was the dean of Anderson Seminary, told when I was there. Dave Sebastian was a dignified guy, and I always called him the Church of God's answer to Cary Grant. Very dignified in his 50s, but he was a great athlete, and so he would go run the indoor track at the gym. There were three girls in front of him that were walking, I think probably talking more than walking, but he was a very good runner, so he came around behind them, and one of them had a Bible verse on her t-shirt, and he caught the first line as he went around the first time, but it was an obscure verse. It wasn't like, one of the verses that you would hear, like, "No weapon formed against me shall stand, or I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." It wasn't anything like that. It was obscure to him. So he runs around, he laps them again, and he reads the next couple lines on their t-shirt. It's still very obscure to him, but he's a good runner. He laps the girls again, and this is his last chance to get the verse. I understand that when a person wears a t-shirt, there's a flat part of the back, and then, there's curves south of the back, and the way the t-shirt lies, you might have to get a good look to see what the rest of the t-shirt says. So he's running around, and he's getting very close, coming in, get the verse, and he got the verse, and when he straightened up, he said, "You know what? That was really dumb. If the wrong person had seen what I just did, I could have to answer some very serious questions to some very powerful people." But the verse was Psalm 56:1 on her t-shirt, which said, "Be merciful to me, O God, for men hotly pursue me. All day long they press their attack." Pretty cute, huh? Well, men are hotly pursuing David. And it's not like the girl's t-shirt. Men are after him. And it says, in fact, in the prologue to this passage, that David wrote this when he had been pursued into Gath. Now, if you know something about David's life, you know that it's strange that he would be in the town of Gath, which was in the Philistine territory, because David had come to great prominence in the life of Israel when he had killed the giant Goliath, who was from Gath. So the fact that David has to flee to Gath tells you how desperate his situation is. He had rose to great prominence, but Saul, the king of Israel, in envy turns to try to murder him. And so he has to flee the country initially. And the only place that he can flee is across the border into the Philistine nation. And so he's there in Gath. And the king is actually a pretty open-minded guy. He sees David as a potential ally in his fight against Saul. After all, they have the same enemy. Saul is out to destroy both of them, and he sees David as this great and mighty warrior who perhaps could be a warrior in his army as they fight against Israel. But he does have advisors. There are others who are powerful in his nation. And they come to the king and they say, "Is this not David who Israel sang about? They would sing, 'Saul has slain his thousands and David his 10,000s.'" Now, there's a hook in what they were saying, because they're making a point, and it could be two or three different points at the same time. First of all, they're saying, he's an Israelite, he's a great Israelite, and you say that he's got a problem with Saul, but maybe Saul has sent David. Maybe this has all been a big act that they've made this, public showing of a falling out so that David could come here, gain our confidence, and perhaps assassinate you as the king. That could be what they were getting at. They could also be getting at this, that he has killed thousands of our own people. You can't be friends with this man. Kill him, but don't befriend a man who has killed so many men in our nation and created so many widows among our people. So they began to plot against David. And so the king sort of has to warn David about what's going on, that it's not safe for him to be in the land. But he can't really go back to Israel, at least in his mind, that time, because Saul's after him there. So he is between the rock and the hard place. And yet, in verses 3 and 4, he says, "Still, I will trust in the Lord. I will call on his name. I will trust in the Lord, in the God whose word I praise, and God I will trust. I will not be afraid." Now, again, he's got a lot to be afraid of, because in verse 2, they're slandering him. They're saying things about him that aren't true. In verse 5, they twist his words. In verse 6, they're conspiring and lurking. And in verse 7, they are plotting. But yet he says, "I will not be afraid. I will trust rather in the Lord." Now, how does he say that? What would be his reasoning for taking such a firm planting of his foot in faith? In verse 8, he begins to tell us. He says, first of all, the reason that I'm going to trust the Lord, that I'm going to depend on him, that I'm not going to stray, that I'm going to stand firm, that I'm not going to be afraid, I'm going to trust. He says this. He says, "Because the Lord knows my pain." He says, "Record my lament. List your tears on your scroll. Are they not in your record? Are they not in your book?" He's saying, "I'm in a bad place. It's not a great time in my life. Enemies there, enemies here, surrounded. This is a very difficult place. But the Lord understands. He sees my tears. And I can depend that on the fact that he knows and understands what I'm going through." It's the first reason that he trusts. I don't know why it is, isn't it always easier, wherever you're at, just to know that somebody else knows? I don't know the psychology of that. I really don't understand why that helps so much, but I know it helps. I remember going out on a date when I was a young man and my brother was 11 years older than I, so I would always go to him for advice. And I said something to the effect of, "She's really pretty, and I'm going to be nervous." And he said, "Well, here's the principle to deal with nervousness." He said, "If you say it, it goes away. He said, so she's there. Look at her and say, oh, I wasn't nervous before I saw you wearing that dress. Now I'm really nervous. I don't. And he said, if you'll say that, you won't be nervous like you were. If you say it, it'll go away. And that's why preachers sometimes get up and they talk for 10 minutes before they get to their sermon, right? Because, you know, they're trying to deal with nervousness. It would help if they would just get up and say, wow, you guys look really rich. I'm scared now. It's like, you can do a lot of stuff. And then to go away. It helps if you'll just say it. There's something about saying to someone, I am really angry. And the minute you release that out of your spirit, you know what? You'll feel less angry. If you'll just look at somebody and say, I'm really afraid of what's going to happen tomorrow, you'll feel a little less afraid in just saying that and somebody else knowing that you feel the same that way. That's why in Celebrate Recovery, that's why the small groups help. It just helps to say, listen, I'm struggling. I really am. I thought that I had made progress, but I don't know how much progress I've made, and I am worried that I'm not going to be able to stand firm in my commitment. If you'll say that, there'll be strength that comes into your spirit because you've just, I hate to sound mystical, but you have released fear out of you. And just knowing that other people know helps strengthen you. Now, what helps infinitely more is if somebody knows who can empathize with you. That helps infinitely more. It just helps to say it. I mean, it helps to look at Samuel Hudson, my three-month-old, and say, Daddy's worried. It helps. I just get a smile there, but it helps. But it helps a lot more to look at somebody who has been going through what I've been going through and saying it, and then they know and they can respond to me. But you know what? Jesus not only knows, but He empathizes. He does. Jesus, if you tell Him, He just doesn't say, oh, I know now since you told me, but He can feel it. When Jesus Christ was on the earth, He knows what it feels like to be rejected because of what happened to Him on the earth. He knows what rejection feels like. He knows what opposition feels like. He came into His own and His own received Him not. He knows what hatred feels like. He knows what it feels like to be hunted and have people trying to kill you. He knows what that feels like. He knows what being abused feels like. He knows what it is like to have your body torn to shreds. He knows what it feels like to be disappointed in those who are around you. He knows what it feels like to have disciples that can't even stay up through the night when He's suffering. So He knows what it feels like to be let down by people. He knows what it feels like to have desires that are unfulfilled. You say He doesn't know what it feels like to be single. He actually does know what it feels like to be single. He knows what it feels like to sit over a city and want so badly for them to turn and ask Him to save them, but they reject Him. He knows what unfulfilled desire looks like and feels like. He knows what loneliness feels like. He knows what it feels like to have nobody truly understand in your circle of influence what you're going through. He understands what that's like. Can understand. He knows what it feels like to know He's only got 6 months to live. I mean, when Jesus, and I don't know where exactly He knew He was going to die. I think it was early in His teen years, but that's a guess. The Bible doesn't say. But we know that during His ministry, He knew that He was going to die. So each step of the way, He knew that the cross was getting closer. He knew what it was like to be terminally sick. He knew what it was like to know I've only got 2 weeks left to live. He knew what it was like to know when I set my foot in Jerusalem, I've got 4 or 5 days left to live. He knows what it's like to hear the worst news from a doctor. He knows that feeling. He knows. He understands. And he can sympathize with our tears. He just doesn't know them. He sympathizes. And David says, I can trust him. I can trust him. His eye is on the sparrow, and I know he watches me. He knows, he sees me when I'm kneeling at my bed. He sees the tears. He sees my pain. Because he sees it, I'll trust in him. Then in verse 9, he says, not only does he see my pain, but I think this is one of my favorite verses in the Bible, but he's for me. Not only sees, not only does he understand, but he's for me. But this I will know, that God is for me. That last verse, in line in verse 9, that was it. He's for me. Not against me. Other people might be against me. They might be after me. They might be seeking to destroy me. But God hasn't turned on me yet. And if God hasn't turned on me yet, I'm going to stay strong and I'm going to trust Him in the situation that I'm in. Sometimes I hear people say, you know, God's just against me. I mean, God has turned on me. It seems like the frown of God is upon me. In some ways that's true, because the psalmist says that he is angry with the sinner every day. So there is a sense in which he's not happy in your rebellion. But there's another sense in which it's not proper to say that God is against you. You know how I know God isn't against you? You know how I know God isn't out to get you? Because you'd be God. You'd be God. You're not that hard for him to find. You're not. You can't hide from God. If God wanted to kill you, you'd be dead. If God wanted to completely destroy your life would be destroyed. If God wanted to curse you, you would know that you've been cursed. If God has left you alive, if you have breath in your body, if you're not from the top of your head to the bottom of your souls in deep, dark, physical cursing, that God isn't out to get you. And you know what? He isn't out to get you. You know what the Bible says? It says, for God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believes on him should not perish but have eternal life. You know what that means? It means that he doesn't want anybody here to perish. He's not out to create any perishing in your life. He's not out to destroy. He came to save you. You know what whosoever means in the Greek? It means whosoever. Means whoever. Anybody. It means all that want him can have him. He's not out to destroy. He's out to seek and to save those who are lost. David says, I know God's for me. Others may not be for me. Others may be plotting. Other people may be lurking in the dark. But God isn't lurking in the dark. He's not out to destroy me. And then he says this. He says, not only do I know that God knows and that God is for me. He says, if God is for me, verse 10, what can man do to me? What can man do to me? Now on the surface, the answer is quite a lot. On the surface, what can man do to you? Quite a lot. They can lie about you. They can steal from you. They can hurt you. They can say very hurtful things about you. Men can kill you. So on the surface, men can do actually a lot to you. But I think what David then is saying is, yes, but they can't do anything to me that God doesn't let them do to me. And so whatever I'm going through, wherever I'm at, I'm there because God has let me get to this place. I think there are really two things that are really important to remember when you're in the kind of place that David is, this rock and hard place situation. And that is this, that if you're there, God has let it happen. And second of all, when you're there, he can strengthen you to be victorious in the situation. It is important when you're in a bad situation, whatever that is. Now, your decisions have probably got you there. Your decisions have played into that to some degree. But even at that, God could have prevented you from getting there. He could have. He could have brought you out of that situation if he had chosen to. So you're there ultimately for some good. And sometimes that good is for you to grow up, for you to develop spiritually, for you to begin to prosper and trust him more. But he has let you be there for spiritual or even other kinds of prosperity. He's let you be. You wouldn't be there. This wouldn't be happening to you if he hadn't let you get into this situation. I went to the doctor a while back, and I had some physical problems, some aches. And so I go to the doctor, and he checks me out, and then he decides to listen to my heart. And he gets very concerned. He says, "Well, I want to do an EKG on your heart because something's not right there. It sounds like you've got maybe a valve issue." I want to tell you, if you got any aches and pains, I want to tell you how to fix your aches and pains. Have your buddy listen to your heart and tell you that your heart sounds like chitty chitty bang bang, and all the pains are going to go away. He listened to my heart. He said, "I'm going to do an EKG," and the EKG came back abnormal. He said, "Okay, you're going to have to go do an echocardiogram in a week or so." That was a tough week, you know, because I'm the kind of personality that I feel good till you tell me I'm sick. And then, you know, two times a day, I'm Fred Sanford. This is a big one, you know. Headed on up. And so you got to think through that. You know, you go on Google and it's like, what does heart valve problem mean? It's like, oh, it's like you got a 60% chance of living 15 years after the surgery, which means I got a 40% chance of dropping dead in my mid-50s if I got a heart valve problem. It's like Andy's getting up there. And so you have to struggle with that. And you know, you say, all right, I'm about to have my 40th birthday present, which is open heart surgery. Whatever. But I kept coming back to the point that if this is what's happening, God's letting it happen. And the Bible still says all things work together for the good of those who love him, are called according to his purposes. And I'm going to have to stand by that. Not happy, a little worried, a little young to be having ticker problems. But I got to stand behind the fact that God is letting this happen to me. And some good's going to come out of this. There are going to be some people who maybe come to the Lord because I'm a little more sympathetic and a little more understanding. I'm going to get some empathy out of this situation I don't have now as a healthy 39-year-old. Of course, I went back to the echocardiogram, came back normal, apparently. So I guess I'm okay. I don't know. But I feel okay now. Now that you told me I'm going to live, I feel perfect. But there's a sense in which I think you have to look at the situations. Say, God's let me get here. He's going to work this to my good. Man can't do this. The body can't do this. Satan can't do anything that God doesn't let happen. Even Job, when Satan brought all kinds of torments into his life, it was because God had let it happen for a purpose. You're going to have to stand by that. And then you're going to have to believe, I think, that if the going gets tough, God's going to give me the grace and the strength to be victorious in the tough going. And I have to believe that. See, I'm human and you're human. And I think usually when I pray and I'm going through some difficulty, when I pray, at least in my heart, I'm praying for deliverance, and deliverance looks like peace to me. So when I'm praying, Lord, this is difficult, this is trying, I got this issue, I got that problem. Lord, let life turn into a beach for me. I just want to get to a place of peace. And you remember how David, in the psalm previous to this, his son has rebelled, and he said, I just want to be like a dove. I want to mount up with wings as a dove. I want to fly away to a place of peace. But you know what? Even if God lets you go to a place of peace, there's also something in the human heart that wouldn't be content there, because there's also another drive inside of you and me to be in the heat of the battle and to be victorious in the fight. There is. And so when you pray to God for deliverance, oftentimes He just gives you strength. Because what you really want, if you could look at it, is strength to fight the fight that is ahead. I mean, listen. The best position on any football team, and we've said this before, the best position on any football team is what? The backup quarterback. The backup quarterback has the best chance of not having a shower after the game. Backup quarterback has the best chance of leaving the field with his uniform without any stains on it, unless he's got to hold for the kicker. I mean, the greatest position on the football team is a backup quarterback if you want peace of mind. You know what? No kid goes out for the football team in hopes of making backup quarterback. You go out wanting to be a member in the fight. You want to be on there hitting, taking the hits, making the play, risking the injuries. That's why your heart craves. Nobody craves the clean uniform at the end of the game. Remember in the movie Patton, I don't know if this was a true speech, but George Patton's giving the speech to the troops at the beginning of the movie, and he's talking about all the fighting that they'll do and the things that they're going to end up doing and how they're going to go kill a bunch of Germans and they're going to be in the heat of the battle. And he said, and then he gets down to the conclusion, and he says something like, so in 30 years, when your grandson is sitting on your knee, you won't have to tell him, when he asks you, what did you do, Grandpa, during the Great War, you won't have to tell him, well, I shoveled poop in Louisiana. But he didn't say the P word. He said the other. But anyway, because he's Patton, right? I mean, if the war's breaking out, I was talking to a guy recently who was out of the military. And I said, if you could go and do anything you want to right now, what would it be? And he said, I'd go to Afghanistan, because that's where the fighting's at. I thought, that's nuts. But see, he wants to be in the heat of the battle. There's something in the human heart that craves the beach, the peace, the sitting there with no issues. But there's also something inside of each of us that does crave the heat, the struggle, the fight, because that's where the victory is. And oftentimes, I think when God looks at us, we're praying for deliverance. We want out of it. And I think David is probably praying for that right there. The Saul's army is there. The Philistines are plotting against him. And I think there's a part of him that says, I wish I could just get behind a rock and hide and be at peace. But peace was never meant for David. Every time David would pray for deliverance, God gave him more strength to fight the fights that were in front of him. And he became a great king, not because he was delivered, but because God kept giving him strength to conquer in the fighting. Sometimes he's going to do that for you. What can man do to me? Man can't do a lot to you unless God lets it happen. And man can't do anything to you when God gives you the strength to be victorious in your situation. David knew God. He knew how God worked. He said, man's not going to do anything to me in this situation. Then fourthly, he says, God sees my tears. He knows the stress I'm under. And he's for me. He hadn't turned against me yet. He's for me. And the people that are around me that I'm afraid of, they're powerless against me if God is for me. He'll either deliver me or he'll give me the strength to get through what I'm going through. But then fourthly, he says, verse 12, He says, I've made some promises to God. He sees, he understands, he'll empower me, he's for me. But also, I've got to remember I made some promises to God. Verse 12, I am under vows to you, O God. I will present my thanks offerings to you. He says, I've made some vows. I've made some promises. Man stands before a woman in front of a church and he makes some vows. He makes some promises. And David says, I've made some promises to God. I don't know what those promises were. David doesn't say, but I think one of them was, I'll serve you regardless of what happens. If they kill me, I'll still serve you. To the dying breath, I'm yours. I'm committed to you in my life. I don't know what other vows he made, but David says, I've made promises, and I'm going to stand by the promises I made to God. I will not falter when the going gets tough. And I wonder if you've made some promises to God. I think all of us have probably made promises to other human beings that we didn't keep. Maybe a lot of us, if we look deep enough, and I think that I could say for myself, I've made promises to God that I've broken. I have. I've repented of those things. I continue to have to come before the Lord and admit my failures. But David says, I'm going to remember the promises. When the going gets tough, when things get hard, when the stress is laid on me, I'm going to remember that I promised God that I would serve Him till the end. There's an old preacher many, many years ago from Tennessee, probably the greatest preacher Tennessee produced in the 20th century, maybe the 19th century there. He's a guy named George Stewart. George Stewart wrote a lot of books on how to preach, and when he would preach in his life, there was standing room only. In fact, an interesting story about George Stewart, the building was so packed they had to lock the doors. It wouldn't hold another person when he was preaching, and a guy tried to break in anyway and got arrested for trying to break in the church that night, breaking and entering. But he was that kind of preacher, a gifted man of God, led thousands, tens of thousands to the Lord. But his first sermon was a disaster. They offered him a chance to preach in that little church. He felt called to preach. He got up and read the text, and his mind went blank, and he couldn't remember a single word of his sermon. And he stood there frozen for a couple minutes and had to sit down in the chairs behind the pulpit trying to hide while everybody went home. And then after everybody was gone, he sort of went home. He went up into the attic of his house, he said, and cried like a baby. And he said, as he's crying and saying, Lord, I'll never do that again. That was the most embarrassing, awful thing that's ever happened to me. And it would be. It's what preachers have nightmares of. You get up and forget your sermon and sit down. But he's doing that. And the Lord, he said, reminded him of something that happened in his youth. There was a kid in his school that had this one-string violin. And he had managed to get several songs out of this one-string violin. And he brought it to school, and George was so impressed by this guy with the one-string violin that he got all of his best toys, and he traded all of his best toys for the one-string violin, because he was going to go home and learn some songs and impress some people too. So he took it home and worked on it for a few days, and he couldn't get anything to sound good at all. But his brother, Tim, liked the violin, so he traded the violin to Tim for all of his good toys. But Tim worked at the violin, and he got to where he could get a lot of songs out of that one-string violin. And the parents were so impressed that they took Tim to Knoxville and bought him a real violin with all the strings on it. And Tim became a great, great musician. He said, the Lord seemed to say, now, George, in that situation in the attic, you've been blessed by Tim's music. And he had been. Many times he had been blessed by listening to Tim play that violin. He said, but that could have been you if you had kept going, if you hadn't quit. If you'd have kept playing that violin, you'd have been playing like Tim, but you stopped. Now, George, are you going to stop preaching? Are you going to stop? To his credit, he recommitted himself to staying strong, to pressing forward, and he became probably the greatest preacher in Tennessee during his time. Led thousands and thousands of people to the Lord. But he didn't stop. He didn't quit. Might have wanted to quit. He did want to quit, but he didn't quit. Think about what would have happened to David if David had quit. Enemies on the left, enemies on the right, no place to go. It's hot. If he would have just escaped, would have just kept going, what would have happened to Israel? What would have become of Israel after the death of King Saul? They would have lost their greatest king. What's going to happen if you quit? What's going to happen? You say, well, listen, you don't understand my heartache. You don't understand the pain. Understand what I'm going through. You don't understand the hurt that I've gone through. Yes, but God does. He understands. You say, well, I don't, you know, you don't understand the opposition. You don't understand what people have said. You don't understand what's going against me. You don't understand the fire, the anger, the hatred that's coming against me. Yeah, but God hasn't turned against you yet. God's for you. That ought to count for something. You say, well, people are after me. It hurts. I'm in pain. This is terrible. This is awful. Yeah, but God can empower you. He can strengthen you. Or he can just deliver you, but he'll do one or the other. You say, it's so tough, though. So hard. I just feel like quitting. But you've made some promises to God, haven't you? Didn't you promise him when you knelt that you wouldn't quit? Didn't you promise him that he would be the Lord of your life? And if he's the Lord of your life and he wants you to go just a little longer, if he wants you to run just another lap, it's worth running another lap, isn't it? It's worth going. You've made some promises, haven't you, that need to be kept? So keep going. Keep going. It's tough, but keep going. Keep running. I love the old story. You can stand. It encouraged me to stop. I love the old story about the guy who got drunk one night, and his wife was tired of him getting drunk and coming home late at night. And I think I've shared this here before. She's tired of him coming home drunk. And he came home smashed. And so she decided to put a sheet over her head. And when he came up the sidewalk, she started to chase him like a ghost. And he was in an he was drunk. and he started to run, impulse. He started to run. And there was a cemetery next to their house. And she chased him through that cemetery. But he was out of shape and wore out. And so, tired, he sit down on a tombstone, and she came up and sit down beside him with the sheet over her head. And she said, we had a good run, didn't we? And he said, yeah, and when I catch my breath, we're going to run again. Maybe that's where you're at. I think David can sympathize with that. Tired, on the run, lost so much, plotting around him, hatred leveled at him, unkind words said. But he knew God hadn't forgotten him. God was for him. The man was powerless to do in his life what God would not permit. He remembered he'd made some promises that needed to be kept. So you keep going. You keep running. You're tired, I know, but keep going anyway. You're worn out, I know, but keep going anyway. Your body hurts, keep going anyway. You got some opposition, keep going anyway. Just keep pressing on. The Bible says that if you'll press on and not lose heart, you'll reap a harvest. Amen. Let's sing together.